still writing my floor speeches. All of them.
The House Committee on Revenue for April 20, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we've just been discussing what bills we have to work today, and it's my understanding that 3171 is ready. 2156 and 2157 are ready to go to Ways and Means, and 2150 is ready to go to the floor as written. I think the first one, 3171, has an amendment to be worked. So my proposal is that we work the ones that are ready to work, and then we come back if we have time before 2 o'clock for some of the discussions on the other two bills. And with that, we'll open the work session on House Bill 3171. Who's on that one? Kyle. Okay. Tell us what this bill does.
Okay, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3171, we do have the Dash 2 amendment and the paperwork for that, and I'll go through that in just a second. But so the underlying bill with the amendment as well, it's relating to the additional property taxes that are imposed upon disqualification of property from special assessment. And it's this is specifically to instances where the property is public property, so it's owned by, in this case or in the example that's given in the background, a local government. So in general, when specially assessed property, think farmland or forest land is probably the best example, is disqualified from the special assessment, so it's no longer being used, and say as for farm use, it would become taxable the following year as its highest and best use, but there would also be a provision of additional taxes of either 10 years or 5 years in back taxes that is imposed upon the property. Now, in the case and in the statute that's being amended in House Bill 3171 is in instances where it's a piece of public property, there are provisions in law that when the property is disqualified, the back taxes are not owed. But this, of course, depends upon the timing of the disqualification, and that was the issue at hand in one example was the Port of Morrow and some property that was disqualified because they discontinued the lease, so they were leasing it to a taxable owner that was farming the property, so they were specially assessed. The property was disqualified because the lease ended, and then the Port of Morrow then subsequently sold the property to a taxable entity, but because of the timing of the disqualification, the back taxes actually came due. And so the committee had testimony from the port as well as the assessors of some of the ambiguity in the law. So what 3171 would do with the Dash 2 amendments is really making modifications to ensure that the disqualification of the property is the time at which the lease ends. So when the lease ends and the property is no longer being farmed in this example, that would be the timing of the disqualification, and that would ensure that the additional tax is not levied. So right now, when the disqualification occurs is actually the January 1 assessment date, regardless of when the lease ended on the property. So it's really just chewing up those two dates. So in the future, if this measure is adopted with the Dash 2 amendments, in the instances where the disqualification occurs and this is public property, there would be no additional back taxes imposed.
We heard this one a while ago. And the port was actually here to talk about the specific issue that they were dealing with. Representative Smith, the Dash 2 is your amendment. Do you are the assessors up to speed on this one?
They are, sir. Mr. Chair, what I'd share with you is we first received correspondence from the Morrow County tax assessor, and then from there we received notification from assessors statewide. This amendment is actually their amendment, and it works for everyone.
Great. Thank you. What's your pleasure, Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to HB 3171, dated 4/3/17.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3171. Is there discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3171 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 3171 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion passes. Representative Smith, would you like to carry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Smith will carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3171 and open a work session on, on House Bill 2156. Very good. Thank you. Tell us about this bill. And most of what we're talking about on this bill also applies to the next one, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
They kind of go together somewhat, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2156 would require the Department of Revenue to establish and maintain a toll-free telephone number and other electronic means of communication to answer representatives from business that have questions about or wish to resolve issues concerning their Oregon tax laws or application of the tax laws.
That's one of those.
And it requires the department to monitor and provide sufficient staffing for the telephone number and electronic means of communication to permit the department to answer questions or resolve issues in an expedited manner. And there are there is a fiscal light and a revenue light in OLIS.
Because the measure goes to Ways and Means.
That's correct.
By prior reference.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2156 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and
subsequent
referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
By prior reference. Thank you. Representative Vance moves House Bill 2156 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that a referral to the Ways and Means Committee be made by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? All right. Motion carries. Bill goes to Ways and Means. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2156 and open a work session on House Bill 2157.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2157 is a closely related bill that would require the Department of Revenue to establish a toll-free telephone number or electronic means of communication for different types of public accountants or people in the tax preparation field. And so then it requires them to maintain staffing sufficient to maintain those telephone numbers and to answer questions in an expedited manner. The measure also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and there is a revenue and fiscal light in OLIS.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Sure. I move House Bill 2157 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2157 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries, and the bill goes to Ways and Means. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2157 and open a work session on House Bill 2150, and that's Mazin's. When we get to liquid refreshments, it's Mazin's job. That's been that way for some time, hasn't it?
Yes, it
yes.
And you're all invited after this meeting for some.
No host.
Yes. This, Mr. Chair, the 2150 is the bill that was brought to you from a Committee on Economic Development and Commerce. And just to refresh your memory, this is the one that allows for the payments and on the taxes of cider and beverages and so on to be done over the electronic upload rather than only in the forms and the paper forms. And this was testified to by Representative Lanninger, if you recall that testimony.
Right.
You have it here with we have no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact that you have on your OLIS, and it just basically talks about the costs that they would incur for the software upload and the software establishment.
Okay. In your opinion, does the fiscal impact statement require us to send it to Ways and Means?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2150 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Benz moves House Bill 2150 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll ask Representative Lanninger whose bill it was to, or at least who presented it to carry it. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2150.
She works so hard.
Colleagues, I think we can. We're ready for a conversation since we have some time on House Bill 2119. So it's not ready to move today, but we'll. But for the purpose of discussing where we are on it, we'll open the work session on House Bill 2119. Sorry, House Bill 2019. Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues. I come before you with, as has been so often the case in this, I come before you with what I thought was my final adaptation to this bill, the Dash 4 Amendment, which you should find on OLIS. And again, this really has been a process. I feel as though every conversation we've had about this, all the input that we've gotten, we continue to kind of bring in and continue to try to make this both as kind of simple and clean as possible while still trying to get at what we're trying to get at, which is how can we best, as legislators and as a legislature, get good information about the policy impacts of the tax credits that we are passing and that folks are claiming. So after a number of conversations about, I know at the last, when we heard this bill, Representative Bueller, among others, was concerned about C-corporations versus other sorts of businesses. So we did some of that. Let me just tell you what the Dash 4 does. And then today, on the way into committee, the always hardworking and attentive Department of Revenue pointed out a language suggestion that they have that they think will, again, get us even a little further into really trying to get what we are looking for and not bring in what we are not looking for. We're not trying to get reports from everybody who has an earned income tax credit or something. We really are trying to know, for these tax credits bills that we are passing, are the folks who are claiming them, are we getting the policy impacts that they want? Are ones designed for, I know I always say this, small bakeries being used for small bakeries or by small bakeries, or does it turn out they're being used by, you know, by Franz or by, you know, Wonder Bread, whatever that is. I there's no trademark implied in my mention of either those, or no implied endorsement, support, or opposition. So the Dash 4 requires a business that is claiming over $500 in tax credits or subtractions to submit the following information to the Secretary of State by December 1st of each year: the name of the taxpayer as provided on their return, their Oregon sales, their Oregon taxable income, the total amount of business tax credits and subtractions they claimed, their total Oregon tax liability, as well as the amount of Oregon property taxes paid during the tax year. And this, I want to point this out every time, because this was an addition that was made after concerns expressed that just showing the Oregon tax would not show a full picture of other contributions that some of these businesses are making in paying taxes to property tax. So that was brought in specifically for that reason. So the filers themselves submit that information to the Secretary of State, who compiles it and brings it to LRO. Who they therefore put together a report for the legislature by March 1st of that year. We also are making a point to have this be a couple years out in response to concerns about privacy, about proprietary information. We, for example, in this bill, it specifically calls out that the first report, the taxpayers would have to pay the first report on December 1st of 2017, and it would be their 2015 taxes. That information would then be compiled and given to LRO by the end of December, and then LRO would have until March of 2018, although actually now, if I'm going to change anyway, I might make it so that we get it within the short session deadline. Maybe I'll say February 15th of, thank you. See, it's good to verbally process. And then that will be reported, so it'll be reported in 2018, but it'll be the 2015, so it'll be 2 years plus back of tax information.
In arrears, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I would like to ask a representative from LRO to come. Sorry, your LRO,
yep.
The Department of Revenue, to come up and say what we briefly talked about the hallway.
You took the words out of my mouth.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right.
Please,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Henderson with the Department of Revenue. As we spoke in the hallway, Madam Vice Chair. The department is neutral to the bill. The dash four removes the department entirely from the reporting requirement. But just wanted to speak to just a couple issues that we saw maybe that might need some clarification. Tax credits. It's limited right now to business tax credits as those are defined in statute, and that is not the entire pot of the corporate credits. That's limited to credits that S-Corps can pass through to its shareholders. So if the intent is to capture all corporate tax credits, you'd want to revise that language. Maybe just remove that specific statutory reference and just call it corporate credits. Second, the use of subtractions is broad. There, we have 24, 25 subtractions that are listed in the corporate tax return instructions, and the majority of those are connectivity issues to the federal taxable income. I think there's five specific ones that were policy choices of the legislature that are true tax expenditures that maybe are tracked. So of the 24, only five are truly policy decisions. And finally, you know, the bill, it says that the taxpayer shall report to the Secretary of State the total amount of credits or subtractions claimed. Just didn't know if the intent was to capture specific data for specific credits or specific subtractions. Might want to just ask for that instead of just a total.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Just those great.
Things. Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Any questions?
I would just like to call out that when I went over this with some of the co-sponsors, Rep. Marsh asked me a specific question that I hadn't quite figured out how to get to that, just focusing on the fact that we are trying to get good policy information out of that for your final point. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Thanks. We appreciate it.
So
I don't know whether...
if I may ask this to be held over so that I can...
Sure, until you get to... Until you get your next amendment drafted. And I think LRO can help you with the items on the subtraction list.
Great.
Yeah, okay. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just ask, what is the policy outcome you're hoping for? What is the, when you do have this information, what,
yes.
how is it going to be valuable to?
I am hoping, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if we have to do that protocol when we're still up here. Okay.
No, I don't think so.
I'd like to be clear. The ability to basically see how the credits are being used. How and by whom, and does that match up with our stated or sometimes unstated in the tax credit legislation? How is it matching up? Are they being applied? Are they achieving the policy goals that we either expressly state in them with certain of them, or that are implied that the LRO has to figure out in writing the tax credit report?
That's the object. Comment?
Sure. I guess the many of these tax credits, because one of our bills today talks about the transferability thereof. Mm-hmm. So really, the folks that end up with the tax credits have little to do with the policy goal, the credits designed to achieve.
Yeah.
They have everything to do with providing funding for the device because they buy the thing. And then their money is what is then used to help pay for the goal one seeks to achieve. So I'm just wondering what it is that this information is going to do that will further our understanding of the use of the credit. When point of fact, I'm going to say a bunch of them aren't used in the way perhaps you're thinking.
Right.
So if you wanted to accept that out, we're not going to learn anything particularly about the fact that they're a bank or something
they're
that actually
sold.
Acquires the things
gotcha.
for the purpose yeah. that we want. We want that. That's right. Why we're using the device.
Right. Okay.
That's a very interesting point. And it wasn't
good
one
point.
Wasn't
yeah.
one that was raised by DOR.
But I would say that there are a limited number that are, they're not all transferable. And a number of them are indeed for, you know, to achieve for certain policy goals and that aren't transferable. And I figure we operate at such a low level of information right now that I strongly believe that the more information we can get, the better informed we're going to be.
There may be some kind of a problem with doing it, but it occurs to me that when a credit's been transferred and the transferee is taking the credit and then reporting it, you might want to ask them to tell you who they bought it from, unless that's already public information somewhere else. I don't know.
I'm not sure my relating to clause will cover that, or maybe it will.
Maybe not.
I like to say stuff like that.
Okay.
If I may.
Yes, please.
So for purposes of justifying the extra work this is going to generate, it would be great to see what the information is going to be used for. It reminds me in totally unrelated, but when one wants to ask to measure water for water rights and then report it, there should be a team of people there that can use that information in some fashion to advance our management of that particular resource. So what would be helpful, I think, to all of us would be an explanation of how this information is going to assist us in making these kinds of interesting discussions about decisions regarding the design and hope that a tax credit generates or reflects.
I will further expand upon my thoughts on that and be ready to talk about that when I come back.
See what you
think.
Thank
you.
Right. Your relating clause is relating to information about corporate taxpayers. It seems to me you could put a lot of stuff in that bill.
Gosh, that sounds broad.
A lot more than what we've talked about today, although some of you probably don't want to know.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Question, I guess, for the carrier, if you will.
Chief sponsor, you can call me that, too.
That would be fine, too. I'm wondering about the costs of compiling this information. We've got thousands of corporate either tax returns and so forth. How many of them are likely to have $500 worth of either credits or subtractions? And what type of time is that going to take to compile that? And should this bill end up going to Ways and Means if it would leave this committee?
Okay.
I suspect that the Secretary of State would be happy to tell us what it would cost him to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the process.
Right.
Once we get to an amendment that the...
Also, I'll try to get a run of numbers on that.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
And as well, I would argue, though, I have to argue in the most respectful way, this is not, you know, a guy with a cipher having to do this and then copy it out on the mimeograph machine. I mean, with all due respect, this is all information that they would already have from having filed their taxes. And it's kind of a click and print it out in this form and submit it to the Secretary. I would say for the businesses, I don't believe it would be any significant additional expense. And I'll try to get a sense of how many we're talking, and then both from the Secretary of State. And we kind of particularly didn't have the Secretary of State do too much with it, because the idea is LRO seemed like a better place to put it into the forms that we often think of that we want them to put it into. And they're more used to dealing with our peculiarities. But I will work on both of those issues as well.
Yes, Representative Johnson, yes.
This would be information that would likely be found on federal tax returns, correct?
That's the idea.
Do we have the right and the legal ability to access that information here at the state level?
We are specifically not. That is why we took it out of the Department of Revenue.
Right.
Because it is self-reported, and it's the quid pro quo is the wrong word, but we're not asking everybody. We're asking if you claim this, if you get the benefit of the tax credit, this in return, this is what we are asking you to do.
Okay, anything else for today? I don't see anything.
Good list going
with,
here.
Yeah, you do. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2019 and await further word. And now let's open again. Same issue applies to House Bill 2286. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2286 with the intent of having a conversation about it. Do you want to talk? Bring it up,
Mr. Chair.
Talk about what this bill does, and then we'll see what other people want to say about it.
This is a bill that deals with tax credits and creating some uniform processes around certification, transferability, and revocation. There's a document in OLIS that I can go through to summarize some of the work done by the work group, but I don't know if Vice Chair Benz or Rep. Marsh want to say anything first, or if you just want me to get into it.
Okay, why don't you go through that document? It is a 27-page bill, and I take it that it needs some amendment?
Correct.
Okay. All right.
So conceptually, so in OLIS, there's a document, it's called, I believe, House Bill 2286 Update. And this is just, it's a four-page document to try and to describe conceptually what the bill does. And as I was talking to Ledge Council, we were getting into a lot of weeds about detailed language, so we wanted to step back here and have this discussion before we proceed. But conceptually, what the bill does is try to create some uniform processes around tax credit information that the Department of Revenue touches. For veteran members of the committee, a lot of this information, certification, and especially transferability, is something that the committee has been grappling with for a good 10 years or so. And in an effort to move that forward, the Department of Revenue came forward with this bill that just focused on the pieces of the information that they touch. So the top of the graph here, there's a chart that tries to lay out some sort of flowchart around certification data. So basically, we're talking about processes where the legislature passes tax credits and state policy agencies, for example, energy and housing, certify tax credits. So a taxpayer who wants to claim that tax credit has to go to that agency and get some sort of certification. They basically apply, am I eligible for the tax credit? This could be, it's conditional on some kind of behavior, usually some kind of investment or something. And then the agency will go through the process of making sure that the taxpayer is going to do what the legislature wants them to do in return for the tax credit. Mm-hmm. All of this information then would be sent to the Department of Revenue in a uniform manner. And that's what the language is here. A lot of this information, well, in total, we have about 31 active tax credits, and about half of them have some kind of certification data. And for most of those, the Department of Revenue gets some kind of information, but it's not very uniform. And so what the bill would do is allow the Department of Revenue to require the information, certain kinds of information to be presented in a certain way so that they could leverage their new computer system. And Department of Revenue administers the tax. So once the information goes to the Department of Revenue, any transferability would be handled within the Department of Revenue. So all of the issues around transferability would be handled within the Department of Revenue. So it kind of centralizes that function. The actual functions within the state policy agencies wouldn't change. So every agency would still have their own process for the certification, but the transferability would all be centralized in the Department of Revenue. And then the third piece is the revocation. And basically, this is a hand-in-hand process with the policy agency and the Department of Revenue, where the policy agency would determine whether or not a taxpayer was out of compliance. Then they would notify the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue could bill back the tax credit. So basically, they're clawback provisions. So at a high level, it's just that process. So the intent of the bill is to, again, establish uniformity for tax credit data received by DOR, and establish a uniform revocation process, and then move all the transferability to DOR. The value of the certification data, it kind of dovetails nicely with House Bill 2019 in that the information coming to DOR, it can enhance real-time tax compliance. Mm-hmm. Basically, DOR will have a list of which taxpayers can claim a tax credit. So they'll know Chris Alanak can claim this tax credit, so when I file my tax return, they can line that up. The other piece is the value of certification data. By providing this information, it's a basis for subsequent policy analysis, evaluation, and refinement, which is a constant issue the legislature is grappling with. So it's also important to identify what the bill is not intended to do. It's not on the path to do. It's not intended to change any specific tax credit policies within the agencies. That's beyond on the scope of what the work group is moving toward. It doesn't change, for example, it doesn't change tax credit transfer prices. That remains to be an issue because the state is all over the map, if you will, on the pricing of tax credit transfers. This doesn't get into that particular morass. It also doesn't change how non-DOR agencies administer their tax credits. So kind of a minimal approach there. Mm-hmm. So it's important to keep those things in mind. So on the next page, we have a list of active tax credits. And there are a total of 31 active tax credits. And I'm not going to go through each one of these, but I'm trying to convey some groupings here. The first group are those that I've identified as some sort of certification required. So I've been talking to the Department of Revenue about this. And in many cases, it's very clear that an agency certifies a tax credit. For example, rural medical practice. The Office of Rural Health certifies that tax credit, and the DOR is already getting that information. So many of those tax credits, about 12 of them or so, there's already some data coming in, but it's in different formats. So this would clean that up. Then there are a few in here that are in this category that I have an M for maybe, and it gets a little bit fuzzy about what we mean by certification data. Because when you talk to the agencies, it is a little bit all over the map about exactly what the agencies do with respect to the certification. Mm-hmm. So that's this first group, and it would be streamlining that. And the other information that's included in the table here is the review session. That's the legislative session that the tax credits get reviewed. Many of these are this session. The length in years is the duration of the tax credit. Most tax credits are one-year tax credits. However, we have some that are five-year tax credits, and then some that are up to 20. The Affordable Housing Lenders Tax Credit is the longest term, and that is 20 years long because it coincides with the term of the loans. And the carry forward, we can see some variation in the length of carry forwards for the tax credits. That's another issue that the committee has grappled with over time on whether or not to make the carry forward uniform. But as you can see here, they range from 0 to 9 years for this group. And then under current law, about 5 or 6 of these are revocable in some form. Usually that revocation language resides within the statutes for the administrative agency. But what this bill would do would be create one model language that is actually based on the biomass revocation language passed by you last session. And so anytime in the future, if you wanted to have a tax credit that could be revocable, you would just point to that statute. Okay. Just kind of clean that up.
Can I interrupt with a quick question?
Please. Uh-huh.
Because one of the things that Representative Bentz's question in general, the transferability. Is there, do you have further down which of them are transferable?
Yes.
Great. Yeah. But should I assume that none of them are yet? Because
some of these are.
Different? Great. Okay,
no, some of these
you.
Are.
Different table. Next page.
Great.
They're very much cross-pollinated. It's a much shorter table.
Gotcha.
The easier issues in the bill are the certification data and the revocation. Once we get into transferability, as veteran members are aware, things get sticky pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So these are the tax credits that would be primarily affected.
We should probably know what these mean, but what do D, A, and N mean?
I'm working my way down the list.
You are? Okay, you'll get there. Thank you.
So D stands for donation, A stands for auction, and that's why I've divided them into groups. So the next group, these are donation credits. We have 3 tax credits where basically a taxpayer gives an entity or a state agency some money, and they will get a 60 or 70% tax credit. Mm. And so in that sense, there is some level of certification data because some entity acknowledges, okay, we got your $100 donation, and here's your piece of paper, or you're on a list, and you get a $70 tax credit.
Okay.
There can be some variation there. The Public University Venture Development Fund deals with higher education, and so each institution has its own way of handling that. So it may not be centralized. And so they're just broken apart because they have that fundamental nature different. They're not doing anything. It's just, here's some money, here's your credit. The next group, we have 2 auction tax credits. The Department of Revenue runs the auction, so they already have that information. I think folks are familiar with those. And then the last group here are the no certification required. These are about 10 or so tax credits where no certification is required. And one of the issues that the work group touched on would be whether or not the legislature should require certification for these tax credits. So the simplest path forward is to not expand the certifications, just to clean up the existing certification. But in here, it's a nice list, and somebody, and you can tell by glancing on it whether or not certification would make sense. For example, the earned income credit is just a piggyback on the federal credit. I'm not sure immediately who would certify that tax credit. And a number of these fall into that category. You have disability tax credits. There are a couple on here, though, that might lend themselves to some sort of certification.
Mm-hmm.
The one that jumps to my mind is the Electronic Commerce Enterprise Zone tax credit. That's one that's up for review this session. And in discussions that I've had with Business Oregon, there has been anecdotal suggestion about the potential value of certification. There have been questions raised by taxpayers who want to claim the credit, and they feel that they're qualified for the credit, but they will ask the question, how do I know that the state isn't going to come back later and tell me I'm not qualified mm-hmm. for the tax credit?
Mm-hmm.
So that just entertains the discussion about whether or not the pros and cons of requiring certification there. That would be kind of in a gray zone between certification data. But a lot of the other ones, the fire insurance credit, it's a kind of a funding mechanism. So I won't go through each of those, but that's the nature of those credits, and they're sorted into these different bins. Mm-hmm. The last group here, we have what I've labeled expired but included in the introduced bill. The list here, I focused on active tax credits. By active, I mean as of today, there can be a taxpayer who newly claims the tax credit in 2017. Mm-hmm. That is kind of up in the air. A number of these expire at the end of the year, and they may or may not continue past the year. But these three tax credits were included in the introduced bill, but they have sunset already. So that's another wrinkle in whether or not the committee wants to move forward with having them included in the bill. Seems like I'm talking more about wrinkles than mainstream. But so then just to summarize, the potential for certification and revocation changes would be whether or not you want to expand the certification process and data collection to other tax credits, and then the second piece would be whether or not you wanted to expand the revocation potential to all tax credits that require certification. The thinking being there, if certification is required, then maybe there needs to be some back-end revocation language put in place. So then the next piece to get to Vice Chair Smith Warner's question are the tax credit transfers. We have six tax credits that in some way are transferable, with the one exception, or the one kind of odd duckling, if you will, is the Affordable Housing Lenders Tax Credit. That one is not transferable in the way that the other ones are. It's really the loans that can be transferred. Banks can sell loans. They sell them all the time. Mm-hmm. And for these qualifying loans, the tax credit follows the loan. Mm-hmm. So we just want to be aware of that and be careful that as we draft any language, that that credit doesn't get caught up in the transferability of these other tax credits. So, but the five tax credits that are transferable, four of them are energy tax credits, and one of them is an ag worker housing construction credit.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a 101 question as a rookie on the committee. When you say transferable, does that mean that one entity sells it to another entity? Gives it away to another entity?
Sells it.
Mm-hmm. So let me just, as an example, so you have a tax credit worth $100. You go find a buyer for the tax credit. And then is there a limit on what you can, I'm assuming the tax credit then has a value. And you have to find a buyer who's willing to pay that value.
Correct. The price for the tax credit, so you have a $100 tax credit, the price that it can be sold for depends on the credit that we're talking about.
Okay.
We do not, the state does not have a uniform policy on the pricing of the tax credits. Generally, some of the tax credits will have a minimum price that it has to be 95 cents on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, the energy tax credits, the Department of Energy is responsible for maintaining a formula that determines the price. And then some credits, there's no restriction whatsoever on the price of the tax credit. So that's the language that we're talking about here doesn't deal with any of those. That has been an issue that the committee has grappled with on having some sort of uniform pricing. Should the legislature be involved in that pricing at all, or should we just stand back and just let the market take care of it?
And that's actually where my question was going to go with all this. So let's assume a credit's been offered. I buy a credit, can I turn around and then resell that credit to another party?
Under current law, the transfers are limited to once.
Got it. That's where I was trying to go with this. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And we get involved in the accountants' conversations about these things that can get pretty mind-boggling.
I bet they can.
In some places, in some of these credits, especially some of the auction credits, we may actually get, in some cases, people who are willing to pay more than the credit is worth on the tax return for reasons that have to do with esoteric federal law, where they're going to save some more money somewhere else.
Right.
So we actually make out very well on some of those. Others, especially the long ones, where the present value is not very high because you can't claim all of it the first year. You have to, the value based on present value may be much lower.
Interesting. Thank you.
Did you want to comment on that?
No, thank you.
Representative Benson and I worked on that a bunch, and I understand why you wouldn't want to comment. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, do we know what percentage or the volume of these energy tax credits were initially issued to non-tax-paying entities, i.e., other state or local government agencies?
We do have that information. I didn't compile it for this, but I can compile that and get that to the committee.
I think that'd be helpful to know.
I do too.
Again, it just begs the question again of whether it's in the best interest of the state to be incentivizing certain behaviors on the part of other governmental bodies or not.
Good point. Thank you. Now, do either of the work group members want to talk about this bill at this point? And maybe I should ask, why is the bill not ready? What needs to be done?
I was just getting to the tricky part.
Go. Talk about the tricky part.
It has to do with the transferability. And as the work group was discussing it, the direction it was going was on how to not change the process within the department agencies, but have some sort of uniformity for the Department of Revenue to administer them. So some of the issues that the group was grappling with were basically converting all tax credits that are transferable to one-year tax credits or a series of one-year tax credits. And so this is a big policy decision. Mm-hmm. Many of the energy tax credits, for example, are five-year tax credits. So if an entity earns that $1,000 tax credit, they actually only get to claim some piece of it in year one, some piece in year two, three, four, and five. And that set the stage for the transfer price being very low in terms of accommodating the price value of money or the time value of money and potential risk on buying a five-year tax credit. And it created a lot of logistical headaches. So the idea was that five-year tax credit could be broken up into basically 5 1-year tax credits. So if somebody earned it, they could choose on an annual basis whether or not they wanted to use or sell that year's tax credit. And for veterans, this was referred to slice and dice within the building. That was kind of the slang. And the value of this is that it should maximize the dollars to the credit earner, and they can decide over time on an annual basis if they wanted to sell that year's piece or use it. The selling would be limited to that tax credit. They couldn't sell the carry forwards for the tax credits. That wouldn't be allowed. So basically, every year they would choose, I'm going to use all of this either this year and carry it forward or sell it. And then there's the issue of the timing when they may be transferred. And this all starts to change under the environment of these one-year tax credits. And the idea was that the tax credits would have to be sold by the earliest date of either the due date of the return or when the transferor or transferee files their tax return. That clarifies everything for the Department of Revenue, so there are these hard deadlines when they come into play. And then that also begs the question of the multiple transfers, because this would be a process where anytime two taxpayers sold there was this transfer transaction, the Department of Revenue would require them to file a piece of paper that said, Chris Alanek is transferring this tax credit to Paul Warner. And so now the Department of Revenue has that complete information. They know who is eligible to claim the tax credit and who is not. And they also have information relevant for any capital gains implications for the tax credit, because they'll know the purchase price of the tax credit. And once we're in that kind of environment, whether or not there's any value in limiting the tax credit transfer to once. We're talking about one-year tax credits, so there isn't a whole lot of time for this recycling of this cottage industry, if you will. And then thirdly, there is the issue of tax-exempt entities versus taxable entities. Should those be treated any differently or not? So if a tax-exempt entity gets it, are they allowed to hold the tax credit for the certificate, if you will, for 2 years while they find a transferor or not? The difference there is that if I'm a taxable entity and I've earned it and I'm coming up to the deadline, the filing return deadline, I can claim that tax credit, and then I have the carry forwards that are available to me. But if I'm a tax-exempt entity, I do not. So at different points in the history of tax credits, some of these, the state has landed on either side of which credits can be transferred. And so those are some of the issues. And then any details, and we're still talking with the Department of Revenue about the exact role of DOR in facilitating the transfer. What are the minutiae involved in that? And so that's pretty much what I had. The last page in here is just a section-by-section detail of the drafted bill. And so it goes through the tax credits that are in there now. It's just, I don't know that the amendment will be radically different from this. The transfer language will be different, but the mapping of the tax credits are basically there. So I provided that information just if anybody hadn't already done that, looking at the introduced bill.
Great. All right, any additional comments or questions? Representative Benz.
I just want to thank Chris for all his work. One recognizes that as he goes through this, that a tax credit is a very odd reflection of many of the crazy things we've done to our tax system. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing we have to have someone as clever as Chris to figure this out, isn't it? thank goodness we have him. It really is something to watch him struggle with the mess we've created.
And one thing you left out, of course, is the way in which the legislature does taxation and budgeting.
Yes.
Because this mechanism gives the Revenue Committee the capacity to involve itself in economic development issues in a way that normally are reserved to the budget.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I might,
please.
Of course, we have the ability to bind for future legislatures.
In this, yeah, with this mechanism.
With this mechanism, and it has other.
Yeah. So there are situations where it's perfectly appropriate to use a tax credit or something like it that extends out over several biennia, because the Ways and Means Committee can't.
Well, of course, we would say that sitting here now.
Wouldn't we? Yes. Right.
Maybe
yes.
Not looking.
Representative up. Smith may have a different view. Fortunately, he's not listening.
No, I meant
I'm taking copious notes on this conversation.
Oh, good.
That's what I'm doing.
Mr. Chair, what I meant was we in the present, being able to bind future legislatures,
yes,
of course, acknowledge the value of the device.
Right.
As we look back, maybe not so much.
That, there's a point to be made there as well. That's right. Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question on this. So thank you very much for that thorough simplification of a very complicated issue. So a number of the items that came up, are those still to be decided by the work group, or have there been some number of decisions and that's what you're working on the language for?
I think for the most part, there was clarity on moving forward. I think there's still, as always, there are additional details that I would need to circle back, but okay. I would also defer some of that answer to.
I guess, for example, you know, like just on the page that's up, the timing of when, like, are those three options and they are going to pick one, whether we allow it, whether we just, you know, or is that still undergoing conversations?
Right now, the moving forward, it's a two-year, they need to be transferred by the earlier of the date, the due date of the return or when the return gets filed, basically. To move forward.
I wasn't asking specifically about, I was just asked, so for example, as part of your report, mm-hmm. there were a number of items that it was, well, here's some options still. So is the work group still kind of wrestling between establishing those options mm-hmm. as a decision, or?
I think where we are now, I had a preliminary conversation with legislative counsel, and as we were going through that, a number of detailed questions started to pop up that I haven't had a chance to circle back yet.
Okay. And then I have another question about the ability of Representative Nose to maybe to reopen some of the votes when he was out of the room. But that's not for this hearing. That's for when you finish hearing this bill.
Yeah, well, if we're done with the hearing, we'll close the hearing, and then we'll entertain your motion. Okay. Well, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2150. Representative Smith-Warner, you have a motion to suspend the rules?
Yes, Mr. Chair. May I move that we suspend the rules and reopen the hearing on House Bill 3171?
Let's reopen the work session on 3171. And then we'll take your motion.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we reconsider the vote.
To suspend the rules.
I want to move to suspend the rules.
To allow Representative
Nose to vote.
Oh, excuse me. Did I not close 2286?
Different number.
Wrong number.
I'm sorry. Where are we?
2286, you need to close.
I never closed 2286.
Close a different number.
All right, we'll close 2286. Thank you. You're right. We were talking about 2286, not 2150. So we'll close 2286, and we'll open the work session, reopen the work session on 2171. And I think the motion you want, if I understand your what your desire is to move to suspend the rules to allow Representative Nose to vote on the motion to send 3171 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
I think that is the motion.
That is the motion.
Thank you.
All right. Yes. So have I stated the motion correctly?
Yes, although when you first reopened this hearing, you said a different number. You didn't say 3171. So okay. I wonder if you need to reopen the hearing.
Well, did I say 3171?
He said 21.
I didn't second that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, just to be abundantly clear, the purpose of this gavel is to open the reopen the work session on House Bill 3171.
And in that case, Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules so that Representative Nose may be allowed to vote on this bill.
On the motion by which we sent
by
the bill
which we sent this bill
to the floor,
to
with,
the
due
floor
pass.
With the due pass recommendation.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Nose, how do you vote?
Absolutely vote yes.
Representative Nose votes aye. Close the work session on House Bill 3171. Was there anyone else? Everyone else was here during these votes,
we were
I think.
Here, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any others?
You missed all the votes.
But those we just moved to Ways and Means. So
we just moved those to Ways and Means, didn't we?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Oh, 2150?
2150.
Is 2156
and 2157. Right. But 2150 we didn't. So we'll reopen the work session on House Bill 2150. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we suspend the rules in order that Representative Nose may vote on our motion to send this bill to the floor.
With a due pass
with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Nose. Let me ask first. Any objections to the motion? Hearing none. It's so ordered. Representative Nose?
I vote yes.
Representative Nose votes yes. Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2150. Colleagues, if you run, you'll be at the floor by the time the session restarts at 2 o'clock. We do plan to meet at 1 o'clock next Monday, but stay tuned. With that, the committee's adjourned.
Governor's press conference.
With that, the committee's adjourned.
Governor's press conference.